You might have noticed that Pat and I are pretty fussy about our finances and our investments.
Yeah, a lot of junk doesn't make it past our bullshit detectors. But one thing that we've both used for many years is ShareSite. It records all dividends, franking credits, transactions, and performance easily in one place.
You can generate reports for income and capital gains, which makes tax time super easy. And ShareSite is completely free if you have 10 holdings or less.
So we've partnered with ShareSite to help support the podcast and provide all our listeners who upgrade to a paid plan a saving of 33% off the annual plan price. If you start with a free plan using our link, you'll still get that discount if you upgrade to a paid plan in the first 60 days.
Just head to ShareSite.com/fire and chill to get started.
Welcome to the Fire and Chill podcast, a collaboration between Dave from Strong Money Australia and Pat from Lifelong Shuffle, where we're going to have regular conversations about fire, investing, and living your best life. Hey, hey, welcome back to another episode of Fire and Chill. This is actually our 50th show. We know it says 49 on the front, but we had an intro episode, so we're calling this 50 recordings today.
Yay!
Yay! And we've got a cracker for you today. This might be Dave's favorite topic to talk about, actually.
Mate, you might have to... I know you said that, but the truth is you might actually have to virtually nudge me awake a few times for this one. Because the topic is actually taxes and how we deal with them as investors and also just in general life and as we approach financial independence.
Yes.
So not the most exciting topic, I'd say, but still something we need to cover.
Absolutely. And I don't know, just looking at the sort of coverage that reducing and optimizing taxes get, you'd think it was one of the most important parts of investing and financial independence.
That's actually a really good point. It probably is covered a lot and discussed a lot. So yeah, you're actually right. But I think it's probably fair to say that we've definitely undercovered it, if that's a word, you know, like we've given it less coverage or maybe even almost no coverage from either of our blogs, more or less, I would say, over the years, wouldn't you say?
Maybe we've given it anti-coverage. We've like somehow removed coverage of it through our blogs and this podcast.
Anti-coverage. All right. So taxes are one of those topics that people get quite, shall we say, passionate about, enthusiastic about, especially in terms of maybe wanting to reduce their tax or begrudgingly paying tax in the first place. So today we'll just share our thoughts on taxes in general and how we kind of think about it, how we approach it, you know. So we'll discuss taxes on our investments, on our employment income, of course. We'll go through any deductions that we might be able to get and some different strategies that do exist to optimize our tax.
Yeah, so maybe let's get straight into it to probably the biggest tax that most of us pay on an ongoing basis. That is employment tax. Ooh.
I mean, these are pretty normal, Pat. I wouldn't think that there's any immediate way to skip around these.
I wouldn't say there are any ethical or legal ways that you can get out of these. No.
That means you're trying to tell me you've got some secrets there.
Oh, man, it's those Cayman Island tax specialists.
You've got them on speed dial, don't you, mate?
So this may surprise some of you, but hopefully not. There's not a great deal you can do to get around employment, pay-as-you-go tax, employment tax. Basically, the more money you earn, the more tax you pay.
That's not a terrible deal, is it? Kind of makes sense.
I think it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, you do on average come out ahead after that.
On average, you do definitely come out ahead. The more you earn, the more you still earn. Tax doesn't take away more than you would earn extra.
You know, it's quite interesting because I used to work with people who would make comments that seemed to imply that they thought the opposite. So They would be people that were very reluctant at doing overtime, and they'd be like, yeah, but then you just pay more tax because you move into a higher tax bracket, you know, and you're obviously more taxes taken out of your pay. And they kind of seem to assume that they'd be worse off somehow for doing like the extra work and making the extra money. Or maybe they just thought that they would get hardly anything out of it somehow, but that's obviously not how it works.
That's obviously not how it works. That would be a super terrible way to set up a tax system.
Hey, do you want to make $50 an hour for a couple of hours overtime? But you'll only clear $10 an hour after tax. It seems to be how they thought of it.
Yeah, but that isn't how it works at all. Is there a situation at all where you can get less by working more?
The only thing I can think of is, you know how you can sometimes get giant, for whatever reason, like very large lump payments in your pay 1 week, and you get taxed a shitload amount, like way, way, way higher than you should have based on your overall average income. So you end up paying a very large amount of tax in the short term, but obviously when you go to do your tax return, you've earned a certain amount, you've paid a certain amount in tax, and it ends up being a little bit too much, so you probably get a refund in that case.
Yep. And I think there's like probably a little weird thing that happens when you all of a sudden need to pay the Medicare, not the Medicare levy. What's the additional one called? It's the Medicare levy surcharge.
Yeah.
So below a certain income level, you don't pay the Medicare levy surcharge. And then above that level, you do pay the Medicare level surcharge. So it's a hard step where your tax, quote unquote tax, it's not official tax if you want, but anyway, your tax goes up by like 1% if you don't have private health insurance.
Okay, yeah.
But if you do have private health insurance, that's not a thing. It's probably minor in the grand scheme of things. And once you've earned like a few thousand dollars, you're still earning more overall. So it's just that it's weird, tiny little things like that. But I'll say that's a 1% or a 0.5% issue that people blow up into a. You know, an 80, 90% issue. It's so tiny, and it affects so little people in such a specific circumstance and to such a small extent anyway. Well, we're talking a few hundred dollars here. Mm-mm-mm. That it's not worth worrying about. And then if you just work a little bit extra, then you'll still be better off.
So in terms of reducing the income tax you pay each year, aside from claiming like little expenses, which we've all kind of heard about, we're all aware about, you know, whether it's like little work-related things you might need or use, maybe it's your phone or, you know, laundry costs and whatever it is, there is a couple of things that you could do to reduce your income tax. And so the first one that obviously comes to mind is salary sacrificing, if it fits with your plans, like if you've made super a core part of your financial independence strategy. Maybe you're gonna build a personal portfolio and kind of live off that, or semi-retire or something, and then while your super keeps growing and you live off that later. So if that's part of your plan, then obviously salary sacrificing is a good way to tuck some money away in investments before it is taxed at your personal tax rate. It is still taxed, of course, at 15%, but that's usually much lower than people's regular tax rate.
Yeah, absolutely. Even though in a recent episode, Dave and I both said we wouldn't do it, it still makes sense for a lot of people to actually use super as part of their plan, especially if you're a bit older and a bit closer, or you know it's going to take that long anyway.
And just because we say that we wouldn't do something, that doesn't mean it's not a good idea. That's
no,
just
not
a personal
at all.
Preference. So, yeah.
No.
It's definitely worth mentioning.
Absolutely. Another way is salary packaging.
This one's quite interesting, Pat. Have you heard much about this? I've heard about it from a few people. Are you, tell me what you know about it, mate.
Yeah. So, I think the one that most readily comes to mind, I think, are people who work for New South Wales Health or in healthcare. They get to salary package a whole bunch of things, like a lot of things.
Like rent. Even cars, like car
rent.
Payments, like power bills and stuff. I think even sometimes your phone and different, like almost every bill you could imagine.
Even like going out to restaurants.
No.
You can salary. Yes.
Really?
Yeah, there's an entertainment budget for salary sacrifice.
Wow. That's really generous, man. And so I'm kind of green in this area. Is this designed to attract and retain staff by making the kind of remuneration package more attractive for certain employers?
I believe so, yes.
Mm-hmm. And so when I looked it up, it says that it was mostly offered by like public hospitals and various like not-for-profit organizations and things like that. Does that sound right to you?
Yep, that sounds very right to me. And this is good as long as you are not buying things just because you can salary package them.
Well, that's the key point. That's the key point, because in one sense, it's like, holy shit, this is amazing. Almost my entire life is now tax deductible. Like, it's, you know what I mean? Like, but then in another sense, you want to only allocate what you're genuinely going to spend or genuinely need to spend in those certain areas to really get the benefit, because otherwise you're probably like, because it kind of shuffles your money away and then you don't have access to it for yourself, for what else you might want to do with it. So you don't want to do too much of your income with this. Is that how it kind of works? It's kept from you. Is that right?
I think there's a limit. Like, you can't just salary package everything. There are like limits to how much you can salary package. And I'm pretty certain that most people could hit those limits pretty easily, let's say, especially like if you're paying like a Sydney rent, it'd be really easy to hit that limit. But what I was more getting at was like, just because you can salary package an $80,000 car doesn't mean it's a good idea to buy a brand new $80,000 car.
But Pat, it's basically like 30% off, mate. No, it's true though. And I bet you, don't have any data on this, but I bet you it would skew people's purchasing decisions because they're thinking, you know, I can do this and it will help me not pay tax or reduce my tax massively, so I should do it. But Len, what you're pointing to is you should try and make your spending and purchasing decisions independent of whether it's pre-tax or not. Yeah. And if you're able to do that and keep your mind clean and pure in this way when making your decisions, then salary packaging can be an enormous saving, an enormous benefit to your income overall.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you haven't heard of this, or if you've put off this because you thought there wasn't a real benefit and you work in the public healthcare system, I don't know, talk to someone at work. You know, they're probably trying to get people like you to sign up because I think it benefits the hospitals as well and stuff. Or
yeah. So, I mean, to put some numbers to it, if you were to salary package, say, $20,000 or $30,000 worth of your expenses, say $30,000 worth of your expenses, you might be able to save something like $10,000 in tax if your tax rate is, say, a simple 33% or something like that.
I wish it was that simple.
It's not?
But I don't think it is.
I always oversimplify things. I'm guilty of that.
I do actually know a lot about this because my missus works for New South Wales Health.
Does she do this?
She does.
Ah, interesting.
And one of my best mates, Mrs. is a nurse as well, so she does this.
Mrs.
Yeah, I don't.
It's like Mississippi. It's like eight S's in it.
So there's like some, I wish they'd just give me a calculation, but like it's some weird thing that happens. I think the hospital gets some benefit, you get some benefit, and it all works out that you end up paying less tax, but it's good for everyone.
So it's not as simple as a pre-tax calculation.
No, it's not as simple as a pre-tax thing, because I think there's like fringe benefits and other things that come into it.
Different items are benefited at different rates?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay. Yeah, I did read that. So it's still quite beneficial overall, would you say?
Absolutely. You definitely save money by salary packaging. A lot of money, like thousands of dollars.
Mm, cool. Yeah, I was quite skeptical at first when I heard about this years ago. But that's really cool, man.
It's a legit thing. It's not some scammy thing. We should probably take a moment to just mention there is salary packaging for people who are not healthcare workers as well, but it's much less extensive. So a lot of organizations will offer like car salary packaging.
Yeah, okay.
Through like a salary packaging company.
Yeah, because there's a few of those around, isn't there? These salary packaging companies.
Yeah, there is. I don't know if salary packaging a car is a good idea. I think the companies that offer it make like they make their money by basically loaning you money and then charging you admin fees. I'm not convinced that ends up being cheaper than just paying for it up front, because even though you save a bit of tax, you're now paying interest paying fees. And
does it have to be like a new car, or can you salary package a secondhand Corolla?
You can actually salary package a secondhand car.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, surprisingly. So you choose a car and then you sign up with them. But I would say that I'm relatively convinced that you're not better off doing it that way. You're still better off just buying outright a secondhand like car if you've got the money.
All right. So, mate, you're probably the person to talk to in this area, since you're like the resident high income earner here at Fire and Chill, mate. So is there anything that you've been doing with your taxes all of these years that you've been on the big bucks? What kind of secrets can you share with us, mate? Sure, people are wanting to know. Don't disappoint them.
Mate, I wish I could tell them something, but I really do practice what I preach here. Like, I'm not interested in trusts because I don't think there's a lot to gain at the moment, and I don't think there's a huge amount to gain in the future. Then there's all that complexity and all that sort of business. So I definitely didn't do that. I make the same like little deductions that pretty much everyone else does. So I can't help you there. Maybe I should have gotten a negatively geared house, eh?
All right, so you're speaking about housing. Let's talk about taxes on investments. And so we'll speak mostly about taxes on share investments, since that's what we're talking about a lot of the time around here. So like taxes on our investments, would you say these are also mostly unavoidable? I mean, it depends in certain situations, but is there a whole lot we can do about certain taxes here?
I'd say there's a few unintuitive things you might be able to do, and they're not interesting or exciting.
but mate, if it saves tax, then it's automatically exciting for people.
Ah, yes. Picking a low-cost index fund with low turnover will save you tax.
All right. Do you want to explain why? And why buy and hold in general?
Why buy and hold in general, yeah. So tax is payable basically in two ways when you own share investments. One is on the distributions or dividends that you get from the investment, and the other is on capital gains. So we'll just focus on the income first, the distributions and dividends. You'll get taxed on this. There's not a whole lot you can do about it. I suppose the only thing I would say is it's probably counterproductive. I wouldn't say probably. It's counterproductive to aim for a high yield investment just because it's high yield, because you think, I don't know, you want more income. Especially if you're still working and you're in a higher tax bracket. There's no benefit I can see to doing that.
Your penalty is even if you prefer to invest that way, your penalty if you're on a high tax rate is quite, it's going to be a pretty kind of a decent penalty that you're paying there.
Yeah, correct.
Kind of a drag, basically a drag on your returns. So you can look at taxes like a drag on your returns and even on your wealth building over time.
Yeah, correct. So as always, Dave and I invest in like low cost index funds, and we just take the yield that comes with that, and we make our investing decisions based on something like pretty much other than that, I'd say, at least I do. And with income, you just pay your marginal tax rate on the entire income that you get. I don't know, unavoidable. Is there anything I've missed?
Not really, other than like the, obviously with Aussie shares, the income that you receive every 3 months or so, there's also another piece of income that you don't actually receive, which is like the franking credits, obviously.
Yeah.
And so that's a credit you get for tax that the company has already paid on that income that it's given you. And so that money basically sits as a credit at the ATO with your name on it. So it's kind of attached to your dividend, even though it's not a cash payment to you. And then at the end of the year, when you do your tax, that credit shows up in the tax paid column of your tax return. And so that reduces tax that you have to pay on your overall dividend income.
Yeah. Now, moving over to the next one, the CGT, capital gains tax. So when I said before that the best way to sort of reduce CGT is to invest in a low cost index fund with low turnover and basically buy and hold for forever and until you actually need the money to live off for retirement. So whenever you sell a share, the amount of profit you make on that share is called the capital gain. So if you bought it for $20 and you sell it for $30, each individual share, you have to pay capital gains tax on that $10 profit, not on the full sale amount. And it's even a little better than this because if you've held it for longer than 12 months, you get what's called a capital gains discount and you only pay tax on 50% of that profit. So just using that same example, you buy a share for $20, you sell it more than 12 months later for $30, you've made a $10 profit, but you only pay tax on the $5 of that profit. Now you apply your tax rate to that. So let's say you're on the 37 cent tax bracket, which would be a pretty common tax bracket, I imagine. So 37% of $5 is somewhere in the vicinity of
$60, $70 or something.
I was going to say $2, but no, you're right.
Oh, yeah, that's 40%. Yeah.
Something like $2. So you have been able to make $30 out of your portfolio and pay $2 in tax on that.
Well, you haven't made $30.
No, but you've been able to generate a $30 income to live off by selling that share for you to spend now while only paying $2 of tax on that.
Yeah, it's actually, it gets even better because if you're in retirement, your tax rate's even lower. And so we'll go through an example of that. What taxes in retirement looks like later, because I actually think it's better than most people would assume.
So you, while you're accumulating, basically you want to avoid these events where your things are sold and then you have to pay tax on the profit, because as long as there is no selling, there's no tax to be paid from capital gains, that is. You still always have to pay the income, but you never have to pay any of this capital gains tax.
And that's why, and that's why index funds are helpful, because they're not constantly buying and selling. It's basically a buy and hold vehicle. So there's when you said very little turnover, that just means very little buying and selling, or little selling, I should say. So obviously, if there's very little selling, that means there's very little and often no capital gains tax payable, because those shares are simply being held. They're not being sold every year or every couple of years or something.
Yeah, exactly. So in the index fund, so take VAS with 300 shares. Those shares are market cap weighted. So as the market moves up and down, the shares inside the index fund also move up and down exactly the same. So there's no need for the index fund to do any trading to keep itself aligned with the market. The only trades it does do is when things enter the index or exit the index, which usually happens down at around the 300th biggest company.
Which are the tiniest companies?
Tiniest. If your intuition is thinking that's 1/300th of the portfolio, your intuition is way out. It's far, far less than 1/300th. Maybe 1/3000th. Maybe not even. Portfolio. Maybe not even. Yeah. So we're talking tiny amounts of selling and buying to rejuvenate the index when things fall out of it or come back into it. And what this means is that is a lot less tax that is passed on to you as the owner. So that generates less tax for you, means you can accumulate more without paying ongoing tax, which also means that any tax you haven't paid along the way can continue to accumulate and continue to compound. Whereas if you're paying CGT along the way, it keeps cutting away at it and you can't keep that to continue compounding.
And so that's a good little nugget of why buy and hold investing is more profitable pretty much every time compared to trading, because you're not losing those taxes every year if you're buying and selling and trying to beat the market in that way, because you're losing big chunks every year. Even if you're making profits, you're losing big chunks in tax.
Yeah, correct. And it's also a big reason why market cap weighted index funds are so popular. There was recently a question on one of the Reddits about why is VAS so popular and why isn't something like MVW as mentioned as often?
Do you want to explain what that is?
So MVW is an equal weighted index instead of a market cap weighted index. Mm-hmm. So what this means is they buy like 100 companies, I think, is in this equal cap weighted index, and they buy the exact same amount of each one of those companies. And then every quarter, as the values of those companies fluctuate naturally with the market, they have to sell and buy to rebalance it back to equal weight every quarter. And what this actually results in is a turnover of around 35% per year.
So that percentage tells us that every company is being sold more or less every 3 years?
Correct. Yeah, there's a full like turnover of the fund every 3 years. And this just results in a whole lot of additional tax for you as the holder, which will show up, won't show up from the company, and it won't show up in your share price. You'll just get a much bigger tax bill come the end of the year. So market cap weight is, it's the only way I like to invest because of that efficiency and that turnover. I think VAS in the same time period only had 0.8% turnover.
Okay, yeah. I think it does get a bit higher than that, but it's usually like only a few percent or so. It's pretty low.
In the most volatile times, it's like a few percent.
I just want to point out here, like we're talking a lot about taxes, right? But if we zoom out a bit, taxes, like I suppose, okay, we'll go back to the first example, like with employment income, if we're making, you know, we're kind of making money, we do have to pay some sort of tax at some point. It might not be this year, might not be next year, but at some point, if we're making a lot of money, we're going to move up in scale in terms of taxes at some point. They're like inevitably at some point because of our wealth is growing and our passive income is growing and all the rest of it. But despite the taxes, it's not going to like eat up half your return or anything ridiculous like that. Taxes are not going to, they're a drag, but then if you're following like a pretty simple buy and hold strategy, they're not going to eat a big portion of your return. They're only going to eat maybe, I think we did the numbers in a previous episode and it come out to like 1% per year or something like that.
And for, yeah, just the income portion. Yeah. Like 1% for a, yeah.
Yeah. For a diversified portfolio, something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
And I suppose to add to that, you don't even need high returns to reach financial independence because yes, the tax is like slowing you down a little bit, but most of us are pretty reasonable in expecting not monster. We're not expecting like 15% per year returns or something monstrous like that. And it's worth remembering that most of our wealth within the first like 10 years, even like 15 years, a lot of that comes from the savings that we're investing, not actually from investment returns. So that tells us that, you know, our savings is more important than our returns. And that tells us that we shouldn't stress too much about tax.
Singing to the choir here.
But having said that, how could we reduce our tax if we wanted to, Pat?
So if you're in a situation where you're very certain that your partner or you are going to be a much, much lower income for a long period of time, it would probably pay to invest in the lower income spouse's name. What we mean by this is if one of you is going to have like a year off, it's probably, in my opinion, not worth like completely changing whose name you're investing in for that.
For one year.
Yeah. But if for whatever reason, you know, maybe there's a stay-at-home parent who's taking care of like lots of children and they're, as a couple, you've decided that person isn't going to go back to work ever or for like 10 years or something while they're doing this. Or if maybe you have a disabled partner who's earning a much, much lower income or they're not working, it would probably pay to invest in that much lower income spouse's name. Now, that being said, I'm just talking about tax here. It just came to mind that we're not talking about Centrelink benefits or anything. So you should also consider how income may affect any benefits you get. But in terms of tax, it makes sense to invest in the lower income spouse's name.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. So we We've been doing this. I know you invest jointly now, Pat. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah, correct.
Yeah. Have you always done it that way? Or?
Well, no, because I wasn't always in a relationship.
Oh, true.
No, I started investing in my own name near 10 years ago, which is actually very similar to when I met my partner. And then eventually we made a combined joint share account and we started investing that way just because it was, I think, if you're going to look at this purely objectively, it's probably better to have a share account in each of our names and kind of invest that way and try and keep those roughly equal, let's say. But I just found the simplicity of a joint share account too appealing.
Yep.
And one set of share registries and all that sort of business. And
yeah. Man, those share registries are painful, aren't they?
Yeah, I hate it.
Yeah. For years, we have been investing separately with like obviously various properties and that, and our incomes were, I'd say, a bit different. I was a higher income earner. And then we kind of tried to balance who owned what assets depending on the foreseeable income, I suppose, and the foreseeable tax rates into the future. Because, yeah. I mean, there's like big dollar amounts involved and stuff. So it did kind of work, right? But, and we kind of kept doing that after leaving work, just investing as best we could based on like as much as we could forecast, I suppose, or guesstimate based on tax rates. And that probably worked, but it is kind of a pain. Like it is... You have a bit more flexibility and it can save like a decent amount of tax in many cases. But having said that, we're probably going to switch to a joint shares account pretty soon. And so with this, like with our property sale, we've had to sell a big chunk of shares to pay for that. And then we're selling an investment property and more or less replenishing the cash. And so as part of that, I'm kind of like re-looking at everything and doing another maybe projection and thinking, oh, what's, because now the properties are reducing as well and things are kind of changing a bit. And at the same time, I'm just thinking like, I just can't be bothered. Like I just want everything to be like as simple as possible. So I think like moving to a joint account is going to work the best for us like moving forward. And so that's partly because our tax rates aren't going to be very high. So even if we're paying a bit more in one spouse's name, it's like it doesn't really matter because of the overall tax picture is much less burdensome, I would say, than it was in the beginning. So, yeah, that's our situation at the moment.
Simplifying further, I like it. I think you can't underestimate simplicity. I think a lot of people underestimate simplicity.
Well, you learn it the hard way. Almost everybody learns it the hard way.
Yep.
Like almost inevitably you think, nah, yeah, I get it, but I'm going to do it this way. And then later you're like, probably should have done it the other way.
This is really a pain in the ass now. I wish I did it different. This isn't quite working as efficiently and perfectly as I thought it would.
Yeah.
I should have just done it the simple way.
All right, I think we've covered enough on that section, mate. What do you reckon?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so let's, I suppose there's a couple of other things to mention with investments. So when you are selling, I didn't mention this earlier, but you can actually choose which of your shares to sell. So you might have a very large holding in whatever fund it is, it doesn't really matter, but you can choose which, and all your shares will have been bought at different prices, obviously, because you've been buying over many years. So you can actually choose which parcels of shares that you want to sell, and that can help optimize the tax outcome as well. And so you can obviously do that by recording all of the transactions like in a spreadsheet and then selling those and recording that. But that's, have you ever done that, Pat? Like recorded this?
I do that.
Oh, you still do it?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I still do it.
I can't do it, man. Really? Why? Why do you still record it?
Oh, I just like it there
you
as a
love
backup.
It.
Wow. It's not that, once you've set up the spreadsheet, it's not that hard. Like I'm not buying shares daily or anything.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
I'm buying like at most once a month, let's say.
Okay. Wow.
So making a little share, an entry on a spreadsheet once a month isn't that burdensome to me.
It must be getting kind of lengthy, this spreadsheet of yours now.
Yeah, it's getting lengthy.
Oh, I could never be bothered with that. I think I did it for maybe like 2 months and I was like, oh, nah, it's all right. So now I just rely, I've become completely dependent on ShareSite's record of all my purchases. Because it's like, it's all there. It's all good. I can see what's there. I just don't want to do it. So
yeah, fair enough. Nah, ShareSite is nice free plug for one of our partners.
Yeah.
I use ShareSite too.
And I'm completely dependent on it. If ShareSite goes away, I'm screwed.
You'll have to dig up all of the old contract notes and make the spreadsheet from scratch.
No, I'd rather just pay more tax. Not worth it.
You can't just choose to pay more tax. Like, they want to know. Like, you have to put something in there.
I'll just put zero cost, all profit, charge me whatever tax you want.
Oh, man. No, so ShareSite does actually do this for you, and you can give them a few different parameters. So,
that's a good point.
For someone, let's say like me, let's say I had a huge unexpected expense and I needed to sell some shares to come up with that money. Because I'm in a very high tax bracket, I would opt to tell ShareSite, hey, look, minimize CGT with this sale, like sell the shares that have the smallest amount of CGT attached, smallest amount of capital gain attached, and make sure I get the 50% discount. All that sort of business. And they'll basically do all that calculation in the background and then tell me how much CGT I've generated by that sale.
Yeah, because that is one of the options, is minimize capital gain, basically. So, you said, it'll sell the ones with the least amount of, or it won't sell, but it'll kind of show you the shares with the least amount of gain in there. And so it can record that for you for tax purposes because you've selected that option.
Yeah, correct. But let's say there's someone else who's retired. They've earned very, very little money this year. Let's say their income on their share portfolio is $15,000 or something. Well, they might opt to maximize CGT so that they're kind of working their cost base up, if that makes sense, over time.
Well, it's really interesting because people would be like, well, why don't you just minimize capital gains every time? But the point is, if you minimize capital gain on your share sales when you are in a low tax bracket, that leaves the larger capital gains shares outstanding. And then later, when you might need to sell those, you could be in a higher tax bracket. And correct. So you end up paying more over the long term. So it's not always better to choose, you know, minimize capital gains tax. Like Pat's saying, because if this guy with this low income chooses to sell the shares with the most gains now, he's going to have to pay tax on that, which is going to be basically nothing if he's...
Because he's still in the 0% tax bracket or the very, very low tax bracket.
Yeah. And so then that leaves the shares with the least amount of gain to keep growing for later. And so, that kind of works out better over the long term as well. So it is interesting that different scenarios, which people will choose different options. It's not always best to choose one over the other.
No, definitely not. Yeah. So I could imagine perhaps in the early parts of retirement, choosing maximize CGT, it could be much better off, especially if it's you and your partner and you're splitting income. You've still got that 50% CGT discount. So the overall tax burden, even after choosing maximize CGT, would still be very, very low. You're still very, very little drag by choosing that. But say in 20 years, the share market's been on a rip and, you know, your portfolio has tripled and you're now generating $100,000 worth of income. That's when you want to minimize CGT and you want to keep those shares with the minimal amount of gains for that scenario later on.
Yeah. Interesting. What about tax deductions, mate? What tax deductions can we get on our investment? There is a couple.
I mean, these are pretty minor, honestly. A bit of your phone and internet for managing your share investments.
That's all right. That's not bad.
Yeah, it's not bad. And if you have any professional subscriptions, again, such as ShareSite. I mean, we're not just plugging ShareSite because they're a partner. But for any of those sorts of things, if you happen to be paying for a share advisory service.
Like a stock picking newsletter or something like that.
Like a stock picking newsletter, that's deductible. Why are you listening to this and buying that crap? You shouldn't, but
mix and match, mate. Come on, mix and match.
If you do happen to do that, then that's deductible as well.
All right. That sounds pretty unexciting, I have to say, mate. What about the real deductions? Let's talk about the big money, mate. I want the big deductions. The most obvious one, obviously, is negative gearing. So this is the big, fat, juicy deductions that everyone wants to talk about. But just before we start that, we did actually speak about this topic in depth in using leverage and borrowing to buy shares, and so how it all works and our thoughts on that. And that was episode number 44, if you want to go back and listen to that. But leverage, mate, leverage and negative gearing. Talk me through it.
What's the deal? Beautiful. Beautiful. So if you own assets and you have borrowed money to buy those assets, then the interest you pay on that loan is tax deductible. So for example, if you have a loan rate of 4% and the assets you've bought generate an income of 2%, you have a cash flow loss or an interest loss of 2%. And that means you can deduct that.
So I suppose in dollar terms, if you have a $100,000 loan, you'd be paying $4,000 a year in interest. And if your income from that investment was $2,000, you've basically made a $2,000, you have $2,000 negative cash flow. So that's your claimable loss that you can declare on your tax return. And if you're on the highest tax bracket, let's say close to 50%, you'd basically get a $1,000 tax refund in that situation.
Yeah. And obviously you can scale this up or scale it down. Interesting though, like with home loan rates where they are now, if you borrow against your home, you very well would be earning more in dividend income than you would be paying in loan interest.
Yeah. Pretty much. Which
isn't a terrible situation to be in. Like,
that's the thing. Isn't it better than if, would you prefer loan rates were 6% and you were making massive cash flow losses? Isn't it better that you're making, because that's the thing, if you're in this positive cash flow situation where your dividend income or whatever income is higher than the amount of interest you're paying more tax, but you are better off. Like,
yeah, exactly.
You're kind of printing money at that point. You are better off.
So you're definitely, like Dave said, better off. Don't try and chase tax refunds. Rather, you should try and make more money.
Otherwise, you might be more attracted to paying a higher interest rate and making a larger loss so you can get a tax refund.
Yeah.
Because that's more, because sometimes that's the problem, I suppose, with focusing on tax too much. It kind of pollutes people's thinking and they get swayed and they kind of start looking at things in the lens of, okay, what's going to get me the biggest tax deduction or tax refund? And that's, so we're trying to kind of bring people back and like it can work and whatever, but that's not the best way to be thinking about taxes, because it can kind of pollute your thinking a little bit.
Yeah. And this will actually kind of move into our next topic a bit, which I would like to say something similar about, to be honest. And that topic is debt recycling.
And so I know we've mentioned this a few times, like we're going to do an episode on it. We are going to do one on it, I promise. We just haven't done it yet. But we are going to do it.
So basically, debt recycling is you take money that you were going to invest, but instead of investing, you pay down your home loan with that money first. And then you pull that money right back out of that home loan and then you invest it. And I should mention here that this is for a primary place of residence home loan. It doesn't make sense to debt recycle on an investment.
No, because the investment loan and all of the interest is already tax deductible. So you're not really, you don't gain anything at all.
You gain nothing. You're just adding a whole lot of complication to your life.
Yeah.
So that portion of the loan that you took back out to invest, say $5,000 in this case, is now a loan for investment purposes, which now makes it tax deductible. So pretty important to set this up correctly to make it easier for yourself. But that's pretty much how it works. And like Dave said, we will do a future episode on this. But I will also say, because this is something I feel people get wrong often, it isn't always better off to go for a loan with a higher interest rate just because you can use that loan for debt recycling. If Provider A is offering you a home loan now of 2%, but they're a very stock standard provider, like it's very hard to debt recycle with them. They don't offer a lot of loan splits. They don't do like master limits or anything like that.
Not very flexible, just a super basic loan that you can't do much with.
Super basic loan you can't do much with. But there's another provider that does have a lot more flexibility, but the loan rate is, say, 2.3%. You're now paying 0.3% on your entire home loan additional for that flexibility. So that 0.3%, say, on $1 million, I haven't done this calculation, I'll do it now.
0.3 would be an extra $3,000 a year.
An extra $3,000 a year in loan interest. So the amount you would have to tax, the amount you would have to debt recycle to save $3,000 a year, as you could see in the previous example we did, you would probably have to debt recycle $200,000 to $300,000 to save $3,000 a year.
Yep.
So that puts it in perspective, like how I feel, how much more important it is to get the lowest home loan rate possible than it is to like try and aim for this debt recycling strategy.
That's a really good point, because it feeds back into what we were saying just before. People might be focusing too much on the tax refund or the tax deductibility nature of that without thinking about the bigger picture in terms of their overall cash flow or their overall costs, which is the total interest burden in this scenario.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah,
really good point.
You could, for example, at 2.3%, like you could be earning dividends more than that. So all of the additional dividend kind of undo any of the tax deduction you can get anyway. And so you've now gone through this whole complicated debt recycling thing, whereas you should have just got a cheaper loan, saved the $3,000, and then just invested directly. And you would have been just as well off or better off because you have a cheaper loan rate.
Yeah, it's definitely worth considering what your interest rate is for that loan you're choosing versus the loan you could choose, just because one has slightly more features, you really want to be really careful about how much extra you're paying for those features and that flexibility.
Yeah, correct.
All right, mate. So what about when we're in retirement? We kind of teased it a bit earlier, but when we do eventually retire and we're financially independent, what's our tax situation going to look like?
Yeah. So this is Dave and I's probably favorite bit of this whole tax topic. I know it's mine.
Because we get asked this quite regularly, I would say.
People are really worried about the amount of tax they have to pay, especially in retirement.
And you can kind of understand why, because when you're living on a portfolio, at least until you might start finding some new work to do, whatever, but it's just you and that portfolio. So you're really conscious of what's going to eat into your returns and what's going to take money away from you at that point. So it kind of makes sense. But as we'll discuss and as we'll kind of flesh out, there's pretty much nothing to worry about.
Yeah, exactly. So let's just use a $1 million portfolio as an example. Let's say it's 50-50 split between Australian and international shares. So your dividends will probably be around $30,000 per year. Mm-hmm. That's $20,000 from Australia and $10,000 from the international part of your portfolio. And let's say you sell an extra $10,000 of international shares to get to your $40,000 income that you're looking for this year. But your gain on that $10,000 sale is probably not 100% of that $10,000. You could probably sell some shares which only have 50% of that as a gain, maybe using ShareSite or using your extremely long spreadsheet. But let's say worst case scenario, 100% of it is a gain. You still get the 50% CGT discount for holding for longer than 12 months.
So you've made a $5,000 capital gain on those $10,000 shares.
Yeah.
And so you get the 12-month discount because you held longer than a year. So only $2,500 of your capital gain is taxable. And so correct. That's pretty low. And we'll actually even ignore that for this example we're going to run through, just to make it even more conservative.
Yeah, correct.
So, oh, we forgot. Also, you have about $5,000 of franking credits waiting at the ATO from your Australian shares from the dividends. So we can include that as well. That would put your taxable income at $40,000 for that year. So you'd have $30,000 of dividends that we mentioned, $5,000 of franking credits, which you also have to declare as income, and $5,000 of capital gains that you're declaring, and we'll pretend you're paying tax on all of it.
Yep.
So basically for that year of retirement, you received $40,000 in cash from dividends and also from the share sale. All right. So the tax you'd have to pay on $40,000 of income for one person is slightly less than $5,000 for the year. And if you might remember, but your franking credit is also worth $5,000. That is more or less paying for your tax, resulting in a tax bill of $0. So, and obviously it would be even less for a couple because you would divide that money across two people and you can earn $20,000 tax-free. So it could be even better than that in that scenario. So they'd have no tax to pay. And so they'd get the franking credits refunded. So you'd have a $5,000 refund in that situation. So, Pat, correct, that doesn't sound like too bad a position to be in.
No, that doesn't sound like too bad a position at all, because you'd sell $40,000 and you'd have no tax bill if it was all in your name, or you'd get a $5,000 refund if you were splitting it in a couple.
Yeah, not too bad.
Not too shabby. And let's remember, like, that 10K of international shares you sold, you could also make less of a gain on that if you're an individual and get that full $5,000 franking credit refund if you wished.
Because we ignored the capital gains discount for that calculation too. So we were extra conservative.
Yeah, correct. And this actually scales up not too badly. So if we scaled this up to $2 million, so if you were a couple, that's less than $40,000 each in income and sole and capital gains tax. So you'd still be paying very, very little in tax, like a few thousand dollars.
Yeah. And there's not a lot of, I think it would be fair to say that there's not a whole lot of our community and our listenership that would be going for a retirement income of more than like $80,000 or $100,000, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I
think most would be under that amount. Most would be going for less than $2 million probably, because then you might also have a paid off house that's part of it as well. So
yeah, and that's another good way to save on tax.
We're making it sound too good. Like there's not a lot to worry about, mate.
Yeah, I don't think there's a lot to worry about. Mm. And let's say your share portfolio does really well and it grows. And then you happen to be in a $3 or $4 million portfolio after 10 or 20 years.
Tragedy.
Yeah. Like, now you have to pay more tax because you're earning more dividends and your share portfolio has done so well. That's not an issue still. Like you're paying more tax because you've been very lucky and you've earned so much money.
I wouldn't mind if I had to pay, you know, you're getting those quarterly installments from the ATO. I wouldn't care if mine were like $20,000 a pop, because how much income does that mean you're making, you know? It's not.
Yeah, exactly.
You got to put it in perspective.
Yeah, exactly.
But, mate, for those people who are very passionate about this topic, let's talk a little bit about trusts and structures, because they're often spoken about as a good way to sometimes protect your assets, but also save on tax at the same time and structure things in a certain way. So often tax savings is the main reason why people venture down this path and want to set up trusts.
Yeah. And if it is for asset protection, Dave and I aren't really speaking about it from that angle.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just talking about the tax implications now. So if you're doing it for other reasons, then safely ignore this section.
Yeah,
I think they really overcomplicate the situation. If you are thinking about using a trust, definitely do a lot of research and make sure they are absolutely right for you before you get into it, because pulling apart a trust down the track can be very costly.
I mean, it's expensive to set up and also run and manage and a complex, like you said, but then also expensive to wind up later on if you want to. And so like why would you wind it up later, Pat? I think this is important to consider because it sounds great initially and then for the first 5 years and maybe 10 years, you know, because you're working, you might be earning a high income. You can spread your income across your family members or whatever and really reduce that tax burden.
Yeah.
But later on, what are the reasons people might choose to wind it up and should consider?
Because later on, as we just described, you're going to be in a low tax environment anyway. Mm. And there's often you and your partner are both going to be in a low tax environment. So there's less need to distribute income to one partner or the other, let's say.
Mm.
So now you've got this complicated structure and you might be hiring professionals to help run it. So you're paying these additional fees on an ongoing basis.
Almost certainly.
Definitely certainly. Mm. Yep. While not really getting a benefit out of the structure because you're in a low tax environment anyway. And so some people then often say, oh, but then I can distribute to my adult children.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, I don't think that's a good idea personally.
Is that where they technically distribute it, but not really?
Yeah, yeah, there's that, which the tax office has recently said they're looking at closely.
Well, that's the thing. Because trusts have been used as a way to mitigate tax and minimize tax as much as possible, there is cases where it has been taken advantage of and it maybe goes a little bit too far or something like that. So this is where, you know, you often hear whispers around the rules on trusts possibly changing in the future, and this is kind of why. So you would expect that if you set up a trust now, I wouldn't be setting one up now and then expecting the rules and everything to stay exactly the same for the next 10, 20 years that you're going to own these assets in. I think there's been too many mentions of it to safely assume that everything is going to stay the same.
Yep, I agree. And even if you, let's say that last example didn't really jive with you because you are actually planning on using the trust to be able to give your children money later down the track and you think that'll be better than
doing it personally.
Doing it personally. Like that'll lead to less tax overall. I mean, I would hope that by the time I want to give my children a large sum of money, they're already earning like money. Like I'm not giving a large sum of money to an 18-year-old because I don't think they would spend it responsibly.
Yeah. Yeah. Depends what you're teaching them, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
By the time I'd feel they'd be responsible enough with that, they'd probably already be earning more money and in a higher tax bracket than me personally if I'm retired.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good point.
So, like, you're paying all these extra fees along the way, which then don't get into the portfolio to compound along the way in the hope of some future benefit that's imagined, in the hope that the rules don't change.
And I suppose it's worth pointing out as well, like if you do, because people would think, well, okay, I can use it. I can see where its effectiveness may reduce. But then, you know, as my wealth keeps building, I can use it later on as well. But it's also important to recognize you still might not need it because then we also have the ability to use our super fund as well and invest through that. And that's actually what I plan to do if my personal wealth or whatever gets to a stage where my tax rate is getting too high to what I'm comfortable with and I don't really need, there's like a surplus of wealth there that I don't care about having access to right away. Then I'll start diverting money to a super fund. And you can invest it in kind of exactly the same way that you're investing outside super. So there's not really any issues there either. And it's obviously a lot simpler and without the costs and hassles of dealing with trusts. So I find that that's a good option for additional wealth later on.
Yep. Yeah, agreed. I feel, Dave, like we're the odd ones out in the finance community by our kind of non-love of these things.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. They're just complex. There's these theoretical benefits, but... yeah, they're not worth it to me. They're just not worth it. Anyway. Right.
So after all this talk about tax, mate, I think we should also talk about where our taxes are going. Because, I mean, some people, we have this aversion to tax, I guess, because we see it as we're losing money. Like some of our income is being taken away from us by the government, I guess. So you can understand that side of things. But it's also good to recognize where that cash is actually going. It's not just like politicians lining their pockets with it. So I don't know if you've noticed this, mate, but when you do your taxes, you get given a breakdown of where the dollars basically go. I think that's, have you noticed it? It's pretty cool.
Yeah. I've seen it.
Yeah. Do you like
it? Not bad. Yeah, it's okay. Yeah.
I like it. It's okay? Not impressed?
You know.
You don't care?
I don't care.
I thought it was pretty good.
Fair enough.
So anyway, I had a look at a recent one. I don't think it was last year. I think it was the year before. And so a large chunk of our taxes goes to the following areas. So the biggest one is welfare. And so people will think, dole bludgers, whatever. But it's not. That's not where it goes, right? So actually, the highest amount of welfare payments goes to pensions, disability payments, then family payments, and then unemployment benefits in that order. So I think that is probably maybe that could even be the opposite order of what people would suspect.
Well, it's also funny because a lot of our listeners might have families, and so it would be very interesting that they might be getting more welfare, especially if they're getting family tax benefit A and B, than people who are unemployed.
Mm. And it's possible childcare payment is included in family payment. Yeah. I'm not so sure, but I think it would be fair to say that it probably is.
Yeah, I'm sure it includes more than just direct payment welfare. Yep. Like it's all sorts of subsidies and
family tax benefit and
that. Family tax benefits and childcare benefits and all that sort of business.
So actually 10 times as much money goes to pensions and disability compared to unemployment benefits. That's a lot.
That is a lot.
I don't
Some people have a problem with that too, though.
In what sense? Pensioners get too much or unemployment people don't get enough or both?
I don't think anyone thinks that pensioners get too much, but it's that whole like paying millionaire pensioners pensions. It's
back to the home ownership, being excluded argument. Is it?
Yeah. But anyway, we won't go into that. I think we went into it last time.
The next biggest area that our tax dollars is spent is health. So you might have noticed that we've got a pretty decent healthcare system in Australia. Obviously, it's not perfect, but it is much better than most other countries out there. So I think that's something that's really, really worth spending money on. So I'm happy for a lot of tax dollars to go there.
Yep.
The next two areas are defense and education. And then we've also got obviously roads and infrastructure, various public services, and then like foreign aid and stuff like that. And some of it is state and some of it is federal. So it starts getting a bit messy. But like these are areas that are pretty important, mate. So I'm pretty happy to pay my share of tax for stuff like this to get funded. Because otherwise, where do we think it's coming from?
Nowhere.
If everyone tries to avoid tax, where's the money come from?
I mean, it's also really, really important to recognize that even if you don't personally get any of this, or you somehow think that you don't use any of these services, which you definitely do, but some people like carve out these little spaces in their minds where they think, oh, I don't drive, I don't go to hospital, I pay more than my fair share and I get nothing. Yeah. A lot of people carve that opinion out of their mind. Your very like ability to live in a civil, peaceful society is dependent on the provision of all of those things, and your ability to save and invest as well as successfully as we can is dependent on all of these things functioning. So that basically, like, you don't even notice them. It's all happening and you have no idea what they are to the extent that you think you get nothing.
I suppose you can try a little thought experiment. Imagine if you got to keep your tax and you got to keep your tax dollars and all those things went away.
Yep.
The health system, the roads and all that, or the welfare payments to pensioners and disabled people. What kind of society would you be living? It would be shit. It would be like a horrible society. You wouldn't want to live there.
It'd be anarchy as well. Mm. Like you end up having to spend all of that saved money on tax, like on machine guns. Like
law enforcement to stop the civil unrest.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That was like a little mini rant there, I think we carved out, mate. So you can always argue that, oh, well, the money should be spent here and not there, and, you know, more money should be given to this area and this one's a waste of time. But that's why we vote. Like, you can vote for whoever you think's going to allocate the resources in the right way that agrees with you and what you think is going to be better overall. Isn't that the deal?
Yeah. I also think a lot of people get like a bit NIMBY. It's like, oh yeah, we need taxes to pay for these things, but not mine. whoa.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh yeah, wind turbines, that's a great idea. Oh, not off the coast of my favorite beach. Whoa, calm down. That's not what I meant.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah, there's a bit of that. We all agree that certain things are good, but we don't want to pay for them personally.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I get it.
All right. So it's probably, I think Dave and I come at this from a position of gratitude, and I think that kind of informs our opinion on a lot of this. It's like, well, you know, let's actually try and think about all the good things that come from tax and how we benefit and all that sort of business. And
we try and keep a big picture perspective. And maybe more of like a philosophical slant rather than a here's where we're losing money, you know, aka tax and what we can do about it. So we try and see the other side of it in a sense.
Yeah. And to be clear, this isn't because like Dave and I pay zero tax. I mean, Dave might pay zero tax. I'm not sure. Yeah. But I pay a fair share of tax.
So we average ourselves out, mate.
We average ourselves out. We definitely average ourselves out. So this isn't some rant of some position where I'm not paying anyway.
Yeah, no, that's worth pointing out. Yeah. So I suppose to wrap it up, people that are more sensitive to this topic and maybe more focused on tax than we are will think that we're a bit nonchalant about it and just like happy to throw money away essentially. But like you said earlier, Pat, we are both pretty big fans of keeping things simple and not, especially not overcomplicating our finances. And hopefully from this discussion, you've got a bit of a sense that tax isn't something that we should really worry about too much, because in most cases, it's really not that bad.
Yeah. And even if you never really think about optimizing your tax, you can still retire very early and become very, very wealthy. So I don't know, your limited time and mental energy, probably better off spent somewhere else.
Well, it's an interesting point in itself, because if you never think about it, but you can still achieve a great result, is it all that important? You know what I mean? You can remove it from the situation and see if the picture changes, and it doesn't really change. So is it all, how much time and effort should we really be devoting to that particular area?
Not much.
So like you said, like our energy is better spent on other things. So obviously our income and our expenses, our investment decisions, of course, and then your personal goals, and then your health and relationships. We've only got limited amount of time and brain capacity and effort that we can allocate. So we want to make sure it's going in areas that's really worthwhile.
Agreed. Yeah. Well, we hope you enjoyed this discussion about taxes. As always, you can get more from us at our blogs, lifelongshuffle.com and strongmoneyaustralia.com. Thanks for joining us today. Have a great week, and we'll see you again in the next episode.